Hello and welcome to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm your host, Neil Denny, and I've just spent the afternoon in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the home of the theoretical astrophysicist Priya Natarajan. Priya Natarajan is a professor in the departments of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Her research is focused on exotica in the universe, dark matter, dark energy, and black holes. She is noted for her key contributions to two of the most challenging problems in cosmology, mapping the distribution of dark matter and tracing the growth history of black holes. Her work using gravitational lensing has provided a deeper understanding of the granularity of dark matter in clusters of galaxies and offers a novel way to unravel the nature of dark matter. Priya also works on the assembly and accretion history of black holes. Priya Natarajan is the current chair of the Women's Faculty Forum at Yale and is deeply interested in gender parity issues in the academy. Previously, Priya was the Emmeline Bigelow Conlon Fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard and was the first woman in astrophysics to be elected a Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge. She also currently holds the Sophie and Tycho Brahe Professorship at the Dark Centre at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. So I'm sat with Priya Natarajan. Priya, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
You're welcome.
I've been asking everybody I've spoken to pretty much along this trip how they became interested in science, and I'd like to ask you the same thing. Tell me how you first became interested in astronomy.
I guess I grew up in India, and I started off by doing a little research project when I was about 12, 13 years old at the Nehru Planetarium in Delhi. The research project was, this was in the 80s, and I managed to have a computer at that time, and I had taught myself programming. And so I ended up generating the night sky charts for Delhi. That was my first project. It was just a challenge. It started out as sort of a programming challenge, something that I could actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was really quite a lot of fun because that sort of sucked me in. But I did have a telescope, an amateur telescope, growing up as a kid. And my parents claim that I've had an interest in science and mathematics for a very long time. From when I was a very young kid, I sort of gravitated towards those kinds of toys in which you had to play with sort of spatial things. And I was rather good at it at the time. But the story goes that even when I was an infant, the way I entertained myself, thankfully for my parents, endlessly, was that I would take a towel or something and mm-hmm. fold it and unfold it in many, many different ways. And this would... I think my father thought I had OCD or something, and my mother thought it was extremely creative. Anyway. Yeah, so, you know, I think it was sort of an early taste for research, and I always liked to sort of figure things out. And, yeah, so from then on, basically, I sort of fell in love.
We're going to be talking about your main areas of expertise, which are things like dark matter, dark energy, and black holes. But first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the method by which you look for these things. You used to be called gravitational lensing. So can you talk a little bit about what that actually is, first of all?
Sure. I think what is incredible about dark matter is that the majority of the matter content of our universe is composed of dark matter. And the ordinary stuff that we are made of, you and I, these atoms are only 4%. They're very, very minuscule. And yet, dark matter is really in the driving seat in the universe because it's dominant. Although it's dominant, we don't know a whole lot about it, except that because it has mass, it clusters. It clusters and aggregates due to gravity and forms clumps. And in the very early universe, you started out with some very, very, you had a sort of smoothish distribution of dark matter pervading all of space. And there were very small fluctuations that got amplified. They got amplified because of gravity. So every time you had a little excess, that excess became larger and larger over time. And so you had a very large clump. Now, the interesting thing about light travel in the universe, and when I say the universe, I really mean space-time, this like wonderful four-dimensional sheet. Hard to visualize, but it's wonderful because once you get the hang of it, you know, everything sort of fits and makes sense in terms of light travel that I'm going to tell you about. So space-time is this fabric, which is the universe, and we are all embedded in it. There is nothing above it or below it. That is it. That's the universe. So what mass does to space-time is actually causes little distortions. So it causes little bumps.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think of a big sheet and you drop a football or something and you have a little bump. So you make a little pothole. So matter in the universe, and because it's primarily dark matter, sets up a real pattern of potholes for light to travel to us. So light from distant objects has to traverse through these potholes before it reaches us. And during this process, there is an imprint left on every pothole that basically light encounters. And what I mean by light is light emitted by distant galaxies, distant quasars. So gravitational lensing is a phenomenon that was actually predicted by Einstein. And it's a consequence of general relativity, because general relativity is the theory that tells you about space-time. And so general relativity tells you that basically matter tells space how to curve, and space tells matter how to move, because everything is moving in space-time. So you have light from a very distant object, say typically a galaxy, which is, say, at a distance of many millions of light years from us. If it's bright enough, we will get the light, we will receive the light, and we will see its shape, the shape of the stars, you know, the way the stars are distributed in that galaxy. Now, because the light from that galaxy en route to us has encountered many, many dark matter potholes, it carries the imprint, and the way in which it carries the imprint is that the original shape of the galaxy is distorted. You no longer, so for example, if the original galaxy from which light set off millions of years ago was actually quite elliptical, then by the time it reaches us, it's extremely elliptical and bent out of shape and actually orientated slightly. It's a little rotated. It's kind of, there's a little bit of a twist that happens. That's what happens to the light. And depending on the conditions, so sometimes you have just a twist, and the strength of the twist depends on how many potholes you've encountered, okay? So it's directly proportional to that. And sometimes, if things really line up, if the line of sight to us and this object is perfectly lined up, then you end up having this light beam split into two. So you can end up seeing two images of the same object. So in reality, you have one object, but you actually end up seeing two images because the light beam actually splits. The pothole is so strong that you have actually split the light beam. And so then you get these two images, sometimes you get four, and so on. So gravitational lensing is really a technique, a powerful technique to reconstruct the nature of the matter distribution along the line of sight using distant objects and the light coming from distant objects. So this has been the most fruitful and effective way to map dark matter in the universe.
So we know that general relativity was confirmed by seeing that the light bent around stars when there was an eclipse. How do we differentiate that bending of the light from dark matter? Is there something different about the light signature?
No, this is an excellent question, Neil, because any kind of matter will actually deflect light, because all kinds of matter will cause a little warp in space-time. Yeah. It turns out that the light deflection due to, say, small planets, little compact objects like black holes, is actually tiny. And you need large agglomerations of dark matter to see a sizable effect. And the effects that you see from dark matter, as I said, are from very large structures. So they're from the extended distribution of dark matter around clusters of galaxies and galaxies themselves. So we now think that almost every galaxy has an extended halo of dark matter around it. So sort of the light in the galaxy sort of swimming is a tiny portion of the entire mass distribution of the galaxy. So there's so much dark matter sitting everywhere, pretty much. Some of it is very smoothly smeared, but it's also quite blobby. There are lots of clumps. And so it's those clumps whose effects that we are seeing. And they dominate. They're much more massive than Mercury, for example, whose the deflection due to the presence of Mercury was what confirmed during a solar eclipse. You can confirm, or, you know, you can calculate the light travel time difference. And that's what Arthur Eddington used to garner as proof for Einstein's theory. But over cosmic distances, so it depends. So the strength of this effect is proportional to the distances of the objects from us. So things that are far away, if there is a well-positioned lump of dark matter, will give you a very dramatic effect. So what we're really seeing is something, a very similar effect, except it's much more amplified and much larger because of the distances involved and the scales involved.
You mentioned there something of the mass and it being, you know, an example that was bigger than something like Mercury. Now, we know that accretion of matter is what forms planets. So what sort of size clumps of dark matter are we talking about? Are there, you know, could there be planets of dark matter? Or does dark matter behave differently to normal matter in its sort of behaviour?
So dark matter, we believe, is fundamentally different from normal matter. And the reason for that is we think that the dark matter is collisionless. So what that really implies is that, you know, if you can imagine it, two dark matter particles that don't actually collide, they kind of go through each other. They kind of come close and they go through each other. And they would stick only because of gravity. They would aggregate only because of gravity. And also, compared to ordinary atoms, right? So if you have a box and you have a small room or a box and you release a perfume in that box, you know that collisions between the atoms of air, oxygen in the room, will transport the smell everywhere. And there will be a pressure that is derived from the collisions of these atoms on the walls of that container. So there's pressure. And so the pressure comes from collisions.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see immediately how peculiar dark matter is. Because there are no collisions, it's pressureless. So it's this exotic thing that is particles, of course, probably created quite early on in the universe, that are collisionless. And they likely don't interact, and if at all, very, very weakly with ordinary matter. At the moment, we really think that it barely interacts with normal matter.
Let's talk about then some of your work in actually finding the dark matter, because you make dark matter maps.
That's correct.
Which is very exciting. So what's a dark matter map?
A dark matter map tells you spatially how dark matter is distributed. It really is. It is a map. It's sort of cartography of the dark matter distribution. And as I said, there are regions of the universe that are dramatically overpopulated with dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
They have an excess, and these regions are called clusters of galaxies. So a cluster of galaxies is basically a very large gravitating mass of dark matter that's about 10 to the 15 times the mass of the sun. That's the total mass. And it contains about 1,000 galaxies mm-hmm. sitting in it. So swimming in it, you have 1,000 galaxies. And these galaxies are about 10 to the 12 times the mass of the sun, like the Milky Way. As I said, dark matter clumps on many different scales. So what I do in mapping is by looking at the distorted shapes of distant galaxies that I view through a cluster, which is sitting in front of us, between us and the distant galaxies,
mm-hmm.
and retracing the light paths, and undoing the distortion, doing a reverse mapping, if you will, and reverse mapping the light rays and their journey, we are able to ascertain the distribution of little clumps along the way that have contributed to the change in shape
mm-hmm.
of those distant galaxies. So it's that sense in which you map. So you're able to spatially disaggregate where the clumps are, and you're able to assign how much of dark matter is smoothly smeared on and how much is in clumps. So what's very interesting is with these techniques, we've been able to, me and my collaborators, over the past few years, have, you know, our techniques are now so well honed and the data is so good with the Hubble Space Telescope that we can now find clumps of dark matter that are about a billion times the mass of the sun
mm-hmm.
located in clusters of galaxies,
uh-huh.
a billion to 10 billion times. So anything that small and above, we can pretty much chart at this point.
You say that small and above. That's a huge thing. So is that dark matter responsible then for that cluster of galaxies? Is that why the galaxies are there in a cluster, because
Absolutely.
The dark matter is there?
Absolutely. You're right on. So as I said, dark matter is in the driving seat of all structure formation in the universe. So every structure that you see in the universe, a small galaxy to a big galaxy to clusters of galaxies, basically dominated by dark matter. And the ordinary atoms that make the stars that we see are only but a tiny, tiny piece of the actual structure that you see.
You mentioned this earlier, but let's talk a little bit more about dark matter halos. So what's a dark matter halo?
So a dark matter halo just refers to the spatial distribution
yeah.
of dark matter. So if you take a galaxy, there is a clump of dark matter. There's a distribution which is sort of clumped in the center, but it has a very large extended distribution going well outside where you see the light. So, for example, in the typical galaxies that I've been studying in clusters that are sitting inside a cluster, you find that even inside a cluster, which is a very large lump of dark matter, individual galaxies carry their own little halos of dark matter. And those halos have a size that is about 10 times the visible size of the galaxy. That's how
mm-hmm.
extended they are. So that's why you call them halos, because they're actually kind of extended compared to the light that you actually see.
So what is that, if that's something that's you know, sort of almost around.
It doesn't have an edge as such. You know, actually, there isn't an edge to a galaxy.
Sure.
But what it is basically the distribution above the mean value. As I said, there's a mean smearing everywhere, and this is like an excess above the mean.
Okay, so let's move on to dark energy then. Is dark energy related to dark matter?
So dark energy is not per se related to dark matter in the sense that we think that dark energy is fundamental to determining the fate of space-time itself. So in a way, is much more intricately linked with properties of the universe. So I think dark energy is something that informs the expansion history of the universe from the get-go. Whereas dark matter, we think, forms very early in the universe, but that there is a competition between the role of matter and the role of dark energy. So in terms of the scientific theory itself, we now do not yet have a convincing theory or theoretical explanation for dark matter. We have a placeholder to model it. And we model dark energy as a fluid with some equation of state, just as you have Boyle's law for normal gases. Mm-hmm. We said, well, this is some kind of fluid, and what that implies is there's some relationship between its pressure and its density. And that's the simplest thing that we can think of. Dark matter, on the other hand, we think is a particle, and it's a particle that probably the standard model of particle physics can accommodate. And the most common and popular dark matter particle is the neutralino. So, you know, they're sort of fundamentally different. There have, of course, been lots of exciting and interesting theories, not quite testable yet, where people have come up with a combination of dark matter and dark energy folded into the same theory. But, you know, I think it's all speculation at the moment. It would be fair to say that dark energy is very poorly understood theoretically. Mm-hmm. There are ideas around there. There are ideas around of, you know, how you could generate them in the very, very early universe and some kind of, you know, scalar fields. What you really need is you need a way to introduce that energy into the formulation of space-time and its evolution.
So I want to move on and look at black holes. But first of all, we've already mentioned this a couple of times in the interview. Let's look at the concept of accretion and how matter clumps together, basically, and sort of forms. And then we can look at this in relation to black holes, because that's your area of study with black holes. So tell us a little bit about accretion again.
Right. Accretion is really the fancy name for the process by which black holes feed and grow. Essentially, what happens is you have a black hole, which is a very dense mathematical singularity / compact object, like the one you have in the center of our galaxy and possibly pretty much every galaxy. And when there is a gas reservoir around a black hole, because there are instances where there's no gas. Mm-hmm. For example, around the Milky Way black hole, there's very little gas. I mean, there's not a whole lot of gas. And so the black hole at the center of the Milky Way is doing nothing. It's just sitting there. It's finished its feasting. But there are black holes that we see that are in galaxies further away that are embedded in a huge amount of gas. And because of the gravitational pull of the black hole, the gas is slowly meandering in to be pulled in by the black hole's gravity to the black hole. And during the process, so this is accretion. So the gas, before it gets accreted, eaten up by the black hole, needs to lose a lot of its rotation because it, you know, the normal state is the gas would be rotating. Mm-hmm. It would be sitting this sort of very dynamic distribution of gas. You would have the black hole in the center. What do I mean by the black hole makes it in? Well, there's this point of no return called the event horizon. So basically the gas, once it passes there, we can forget about it. No information, you know nothing, right? And that's the point from which even light, you don't get light out of there. And so the gas has to somehow lose a lot of its angular momentum or spin, its rotation, and reach there, because then it will actually be totally absorbed by the black hole, gravitationally taken in. And during that process, that's the accretion process, you know, it happens with varying efficiency. You can imagine that there are some configurations where the feeding is faster, the gas can make it in faster. And there are, obviously, if there's not much rotation, you can feed very furiously. But the process of accretion, during the accretion process, energy is released because the gas is pulled and it's speeding up. because of the gravitational attraction of the black hole, is speeding up on and on its way into the black hole, a small portion of the rest mass energy of this gas gets converted into radiation. And often for these supermassive black holes, and what I mean by supermassive is something that's a million times the mass of the sun, you know, the big exotic beasts. There, what you find is that a small portion of that energy that's released comes out in the X-ray. And that's how you see the black holes. So you see them feeding.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can see them even in optical wavelengths. And that's when you see this quasar. So those are actively feeding black holes, can be seen either as quasars or as X-ray sources.
I'd like to talk a little bit about why there are black holes, I guess, how the black holes first formed. And you have a take on this.
Yeah. So I think that black holes, or sort of these very compact objects, are an inevitable state that you get once you form, say, the first star in the universe. You may form the first star, it depletes its hydrogen and helium, and the first stars that formed in the universe were slightly different from the stars that formed later on, because there are no metals in the universe to start with. All the metals that we have in the universe were synthesized inside supernovae. So you need to have the whole process going once before you got anything else out. So the first go around, you had very special kinds of stars. These are called population 3 stars. And these stars, the end state, after exhausting their fuel, they become little black holes. Mm-hmm. Some of them leave little black holes, depending on the initial mass that you were able to make the star with. So, and this was the common wisdom, that you would make this little seed black hole, and then by accretion, the process we just talked about, you would just grow the mass of a black hole, and that would naturally, over cosmic time, you know, 13, 12, 10 billion years, give you something that's a billion times the mass of the sun, or a million times the mass of the sun, sort of the garden variety supermassive black hole that you find in the center of galaxies like our own. But it turns out that the reason I have an interesting and I think an exciting take on it, if I may say so myself, is that we are starting, with the instrumentation that we have, we are starting to find these quasars, these accreting black holes, feasting black holes, at earlier and earlier times. And the brightnesses of these objects tells you how massive they are. So how much light, how much radiation you get en route to being consumed depends on the gravitational pull, and the gravitational pull depends on the mass. So from the brightness of these extremely luminous quasars that one was starting to see when the universe was a fraction of its current age, 2 billion years. So there's evidence now that there are a billion solar mass black holes, right? A billion times the mass of the sun, already in place, feasting, when the universe was just 2 billion years old. And the question is, if you form them from the piddly little seeds of the first stars, there's no way you could grow them up that fast. Even if you sort of overfeed them, force feed them, it's very, very hard. It's very challenging in the models. And the thing with our universe, right, is that if you find one freaky object, we can always explain it. You know, it's a freak, but you know, it's a statistical fluke, but it's a rare event and it can happen. But the problem is you start finding populations of them. Then you need a physical explanation for how you make that whole class of objects. So people had started finding for the last 6-7 years, this whole population is in place. And the deeper we look, we are finding more and more populations. The deeper we look, we can catch fainter things. So we're starting to look at a really solid population in place at earlier and earlier times. So you need a new way to make the seeds. So with my postdoctoral collaborator, Giuseppe Lodato, who's now a professor at the University of Milan, we came up with a clever little idea, which, you know, is rather obvious, right? All you have to do is to make the seeds bigger. And the question is, are there conditions in the universe that would enable you to basically make more massive seeds? And what would those conditions be? So we investigated and we figured out that, well, you know, you need certain configurations of gas, you need certain temperatures, and you need a certain kind of environment, an environment where a lot of gas can flow in very swiftly and form very compact objects. And we realized that those conditions are actually available in the early universe. So we were able to predict that you could make these very massive black hole seeds. So you make something in the picture that we have, you can make a seed that is already, to start out with, about 10,000 times to a million times the mass of the sun. Very, very early on. So such a beast doesn't have to feed all that much to grow in mass to a billion solar mass black hole very early on in the universe. So, and you know, what is very exciting about this sort of alternate picture is that, you know, it's garnering a lot of evidence. Because we are finding, as I said, you're finding populations. So the prediction of this model would be that you have accreting, feasting black holes well in place very, very early on in the universe. And so we are discovering them progressively. So it's kind of exciting.
We talked a little while ago about the, you know, the idea of the dark matter playing a significant role in keeping a cluster of galaxies together. So there tends to be a supermassive black hole at the centre of galaxies. So what role does that play?
So that is an area of extremely active research right now. So as you can imagine, right, the dark matter halo in a galaxy as well is by mass the dominant component. It's very extended, however, and that's why it's a halo, and you have the stars in the center. And the black hole, the mass of the black hole in the center of our galaxy is a very, very small percentage of the total mass of the galaxy. So, for example, for the Milky Way, as I mentioned earlier, the mass of the central black hole is a million times the mass of the sun. The total mass of our galaxy, dominated by dark matter, 90% is dark matter, is 10 to the 12. So there's a six orders of magnitude. So the black hole is a millionth the mass of the entire galaxy. So although it has intense gravity, its range of influence is tiny. However, it's sitting in a very critical, important place because all the stars are forming in the center and the stars are settled right around the black hole. And in fact, we have some interesting and important glimpses into the fact that the black hole and the formation of the stars, the growth of the black hole and the formation of the stars are probably interlinked. There's some real profound interplay between them. It's not surprising because both entities, as I just finished telling you, form from gas. So, you know, gas forms stars, gas forms black holes. So it's not surprising that there's some correlation. But there's a very strong correlation, it seems, between the mass of the stars that lie in the innermost region right around the black hole, outside the region where they're going to be swallowed, right? They're safe and they're sitting there, and the mass of the black hole. And we think that all of this accretion onto the black hole, this slow feeding of gas or fast feeding of gas, and the energy that it produces actually modulates the energy content in the inner regions of a galaxy. So it actually plays an oversized role. You know, there are these exotic objects, rare objects, one thought. They're not so rare anymore. They're sitting in the center of every galaxy. And they are sort of the prima donna, even though, they, as I said, they're only the millionth of the mass. So we think that somehow black holes fundamentally regulate. They don't regulate anything that has to do with the dark matter, because the dark matter is very extended. But we think the radiation, and also, you know, radiation doesn't couple to dark matter. Dark matter is impervious to radiation. And so the only thing that the black hole does is interact with the baryonic, or the ordinary atom component, which is gas and stars in the center.
Just one other point then before we move on from black holes. Another one of your areas of research is around binary black holes. Now, I know what a binary star is. We're talking about two stars that rotate around each other, have a relationship. So is that the same thing that we're talking
Absolutely.
About
Absolutely. And the reason you have binary black holes to start with is quirk of structure formation in our universe. Structure forms in our universe by hierarchical merging. So you form small blobs of dark matter that form tiny galaxies, and then those galaxies merge. And what I mean by that is their dark matter halos merge, the stars merge, and the central black holes merge. So the process, you end up with binaries as a result of the merging process. And so for the merger to be completed, for two galaxies to have completely merged, everything has to be nicely mixed in, including the black hole. So the two binaries will eventually coalesce and form one black hole.
Moving on then, completely from the actual the cosmology. During this trip, I've been trying to talk to people about the contrasts between science in the US and the UK. And you're chair of the Women's Faculty Forum at Yale. So I'd like to perhaps talk a little bit, if we can, about the conditions for women working in science. And I've been on this trip for a month and I've interviewed quite a lot of women scientists, and it may be, I'm sure this is entirely my, you know, my bias causing this, but I've spoken to a lot of women scientists that are involved in cosmology and astronomy. So is this a field that's particularly attractive to women, I guess?
Yeah, so these are very interesting and important questions. Well, I do think that the field of astronomy has been very open to women, and there's a very long tradition of astronomy, women employed in observatories and so on. But I think that it is like for any group that is not the dominant group traditionally, it is a challenge for women in science. And I think there are particular kinds of challenges. And I think one of the critical ones that I see has to do with, you know, it starts quite early on. We live in a society and culture where there are very strong gender stereotypes of what it is okay for somebody to do and what it's not okay for someone to do. And the gender stereotyping often is responsible for getting girl kids quite early on turned off from science and mathematics, which I think is very, very sad. But, you know, the reason that's sad is because it ratchets up later on. So you have fewer women going into science later on. And then once the ones that do make it, there are further challenges. And the challenges primarily come from the fact that the way the educational professional track for scientists is set up, it's a very linear track that you have to follow. And you cannot stray from that path. You can't take time off from that path. There's very little flexibility. So, you know, you do your undergraduate, you do your postgraduate, then you do a postdoctoral research apprentice stage, and then you become a faculty member. And, of course, for women, a lot of the timing on this track coincides with a time when you possibly want to have a family. I mean, it coincides for men, too, but women bear the biological burden. Mm-hmm. So I think that is often... It has often been historically seen, not just in science, but in all professions, that, you know, having a career and a family, it's not clear how to balance that. So it used to be that it was a choice in the past, and now it is no longer seen as a choice. Mm-hmm. It's seen as a juggling act and, you know, how you juggle. And I think there are some very important cultural differences in the UK and in the US vis-a-vis... I think that in America, partly because of the size and the scale and the range of institutions, there's more openness because mm-hmm. there are more positions. Science is very poorly funded, as you know. I mean, research careers, we depend on federal funding mm-hmm. and from agencies that are federally funded by taxpayer money. And it's scarce for basic research in general. So the pressures are very high. But in a country like America, there's a whole range of institutions of professional aspirations of women can be fulfilled. And so, you know, it's more open, I think. And I think Britain, because the scale is smaller, and I think also there aren't as many helpful programmatic things in place to really encourage women and young girls to not drop out.
So then the last question then would be, because it's a biggie, what can be done? What could we do to change things to make it access more easy?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, there are a couple of things. I mean, there are things that one can do within the profession, and then there are sort of the larger societal things that need to happen, right? I think that in terms of educational institutions, what needs to really happen is that institutions need to learn to be flexible, open-minded about, you know, things like a maternity leave, paternity leave, childcare for men and women scholars. So I think sort of, you know, facilitating this balancing act better would make a big difference. And of course, the attitude changes. I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, women were not part of this game and they're entering this game, it's a fun and exciting game to be part of. And I think, you know, the attitude has to be one of openness and welcoming them and welcoming sort of this new surge of sort of a different demographic from what was previously there. So I think institutions can do a lot. But society in general, I think that, you know, gender parity, you know, it is such a deeply held aspiration for me that it's hard to see why the rest of society doesn't buy into it. But I think what would be fantastic is if society as a whole realizes that women are half the population, and you really want to not lose half of the talent pool and to make that a sort of, you know, a general societal value that, you know, we want parity, I think would be fantastic, and that would change things.
That's a great point for us to end on. So I've been talking to Priya Natarajan. Priya, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you so much, Neil. It was a real pleasure.
I'm Professor Sarah Seeger. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.